lesson 11, how to have a good name. I want to go back for just a moment because we didn't quite finish the lesson that was on last week, and I want to just talk about a couple of these things. We talked about people being willing to listen to counsel, and in verse 20, this comes up again, a know-it-all always shows his ignorance because he thinks he knows everything, and he won't listen to advice when someone who knows what they're doing gives advice, and he won't listen to it. And then we talked about the lazy man, or we come to the lazy man. I think about verse 24 is where we are tonight of chapter 19. And the wise man there says, a lazy man buries his hand in a bowl and will not so much as bring it to his mouth again. You know, Solomon has a lot to say about laziness, doesn't he? He's had a lot. In almost every chapter of the 19 chapters that we've been through so far, Solomon has talked about someone being lazy and someone that will not work. And the image that he presents to us here now is someone who is hungry, and they will put their hand in the bowl, but they won't so much as raise their hand to their mouth to eat. Now, that's an extreme case, I know. But he's talking about someone who is extremely lazy, and someone who just gripes and complains about every task that he's required to perform, even that of having to eat for himself. Now, I don't know if I've ever known anyone that's quite that lazy, but that would be a shame. Most of my friends here at Neely's Bend don't have any problem eating. all of us can eat quite well, but that would be an extreme case for sure. Then he goes on in verse 25 and he says, strike a scoffer and the simple will become wary. Rebuke one who has understanding and he will discern knowledge. You know what a scoffer is? That's someone who belittles everything. Someone who scorns everything. Projects, wisdom, good works, knowledge, whatever you want to talk about. A scoffer is someone that's going to belittle it and is going to put it down. And what he's saying, you can beat a scoffer. You can actually take them out and beat them, and it will not bring them around to sound thinking. It just won't do it. But he says a simple man, and what I've been able to glean from this study, and he has mentioned a simple person several times in our study so far, but it means a naive person. Someone that is not very wise to the ways of the world and the ways of life, but he says a naive person might benefit by the warning. And he's talking about if the naive person was standing here and you took the scoffer and you beat him about the head and shoulders, the naive person would actually take a lesson from that, and it would improve their attitude and their ability to perform in every way. And he doesn't have much use for someone like that, it seems like. And many of these things that we've got in the rest of this chapter and the next chapter too, I went through verse after verse of proverb after proverb of chapter 20, and I just made a note. It's already been covered. But some of the things we'll probably look at again as we go along. In verse 26, he said, he who mistreats his father and chases away his mother is a son who causes shame and brings reproach. Cease listening to instruction, my son, and you will stray from the words of knowledge. A son who has such disrespect as what is described here as to drive his mother away is a shameful and disgraceful son. I mean, there's not any doubt about that. Why wouldn't someone just leave? Why wouldn't the son just leave rather than to disrespect his father and drive his mother away, like the wise man is saying here? But what about a son that just won't listen to their parents? In an honorable situation, in a good family, the parents are wiser than the children, at least up until a certain point, and I would argue that in most cases, even past that point, because there is some wisdom that just comes with age that a younger person will not have, is there not? I mean, when someone attains the age of 70 years or 80 years or something like that, there is some wisdom that just comes along with that. There's nothing you can do about it. Just wisdom that comes with living a life and just going through and having the experiences and learning from the lessons that you have throughout just living a life. Verse 28, a disreputable witness scorns justice, and the mouth of the wicked devours iniquity. The very idea that in the United States of America, someone would get on a witness stand in a court of law and have their testimony purchased for money just escapes me. I can't understand why anyone would do that, but I know that people will, that some people will. I guess maybe I'm just too patriotic to even think about doing something like that. But that's what he's talking about here, is a disreputable witness, and what the wise man is saying, that he just scorns justice. You know, he just doesn't care if justice is done or not, just so he profits from what's going on there. And it's just a terrible situation. In verse 29, he said, judgments are prepared for scoffers and beatings for the backs of fools. I think that's funny every time I read that. It says, it reminds me, you know, my daddy would have said to me, son, a good beating was just made for you. Beatings were invented because someone knew you would come along. and you would need it. I think my brother and I was talking with somebody here last Sunday, I believe. But I think my brother and I got the belt every night just about as regularly as we went to bed. Who was I talking with about that? Someone. Was it you, Billy? No, it wasn't Billy. But we was talking about that on Sunday. But I just remember getting it regularly. And I don't believe for a minute that my daddy ever hurt us. But we thought we was hurt. we sure thought that we were injured at the time. But I'm pretty sure that he never hurt us. I don't think he probably ever hit us very hard. But we thought it was. The belt can be a fairly scary thing when you're about 10 or 11 years old. I don't know if anybody gets the belt these days or not. Do you, Ricky? I never did have a razor strap. I think that was my dad's punishment. He, I know. Well, I can imagine. I've got one, and the leather's about that thick. It might actually do some damage. I don't know.
But don't you think that was wrong?
What was wrong?
To use a razor strap. My dad never had to use a razor.
Well, see, the razor strap has two parts. And when you hit with it, those parts slap together and makes a really loud pop. I don't think that the wise man here is in any way sanctioning abusive punishment. I don't believe that for a minute. But I think, you know, we know in our society that punishment can be a deterrent to some people. And I'm talking about just getting a speeding ticket, Van. That comes up again in chapter 20, by the way, almost the same verse that we had. But just getting a fine, maybe you have to pay $90 or $100 or something. But when you go through that area the next time, doesn't it make you more aware of the speed limit? Yes. Now, some people, it doesn't, I guess. But I learned a lesson pretty quickly when you start getting in my pocketbook.
I just looked at that razor strap down there.
Did it? I bet you were just a charming child. who said?
What is abusive punishment?
Well, I think injurious punishment would be abusive. You know, if you're going to injure, if you injured somebody.
Well, you injure if they hit you and it cracks the skin. Have you ever been whipped?
I missed you so badly. Do what? Go ahead. Oh, that was my mother's punishment. My dad's was the belt. Yeah.
Uh-huh. It doesn't do any permanent damage. Mommy said, I'll cut the blood out of you.
My dad used to say
that. Woody's got a comment.
Woody. I've always wanted to meet somebody like you. I had an uncle that used to tell us that when they got up in the morning, they got a whipping, not because of what they did, but what they was going to do. Oh, see, that's nice.
Yeah.
I had a teacher that'd do that. But Mary Jane's not enjoying this.
No, I don't approve of all that beating. I wasn't brought up in that kind of a home. Mm-hmm.
There's some kids, though, that have to have it to be this one.
I digress back to what I said. I'm sure that my daddy never hurt us. and I don't think most parents do. You know, it worked.
Yeah. You don't make them feel good.
It worked.
That's
done. It's it worked. It's really.
I had a good friend of mine that had a young one like that, and he'd whip him right regular, and he'd go right back and do the same thing again.
Yeah.
And he'd whip him again, he'd go back and do the same thing again.
Yeah.
Then we talked about that, and I said, well, what are you going to do to stop him from doing all that? I don't know. I reckon why I'd kill him. I said, now you don't need to do that. You don't need to do that. I said, but seriously, I said, what are we going to do? What are you going to do to get him stopped? I said, I don't know. I guess I'm going to find some other part.
Yeah.
It's not any good.
Think about this. The reason that people commit the crime the second time is because the punishment wasn't enough the first time. You can't punish equal to the crime and expect to get any results.
I don't know that I agree with you completely, but I understand. I understand what you're saying. But I've known people that just believe that the punishment is the price they pay for doing what they want to do. And they will continue to do it.
Because they want to do whatever it is.
Yeah.
But if it gets to the point that this punishment
what, honey?
Is greater than whatever they feel, the enjoyment they feel committed, at a point they're quit.
Yeah.
They may be laying in a casket, but at a point they're quit.
I have a daughter you can't punish because she feels like what I said, that it's just the price she pays for doing what. I understand what you're saying, though, but I don't think that Solomon is sanctioning abusive parenting here.
They're not abusive again. See?
Huh?
It depends on what you call abusive.
Yeah. And again, I've just missed you so much. Oh, me. Yes.
I personally feel that part of our problems in society today is that parents do not punish the children to whatever degree. They just, you know, what is it that's going to stand
Yeah.
Yeah, I get a break. I get time out.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's no fun.
Yeah. There's something about responsibility.
Something to teach them responsibility.
Yeah.
This is right and this is wrong. You don't do the wrong.
And there are consequences for everything we do. You just stop and think about it. You know, it's that big ledger sheet that I talked about with the debit column and the credit column. And every time something goes in one column, there has to be an offsetting entry in the other column. And our lives are the same way. You know, if you want something on this side, there has to be a payment on this side too. And so when we do something, there are consequences for what we do. And I think that's where a lot of and I'm no expert. I sure don't know what people are taught or not, but I watch the news and see other things and read some things. And, it seems to me that a lot of young people these days are not taught that there are consequences. That when you do something, there's going to be consequences. And if they're not taught when they're young and at home in that small, home society and realm, then it's going to be a rude awakening when they step out into the world and they have to deal with the local police force, who is not going to be nearly as lenient as their parents have been.
We
so,
in fact, when our children, our girls were growing up, mm-hmm. they had a curfew. And during the week, it was 10 o'clock. And at 4 till 10, one of the girls would come in. I mean, at 10 o'clock, when it was right straight up, you'd hear the other tire screeching in the driveway.
Mm-hmm. Red West. Yeah. That's good. I can't hardly believe that you had trouble with your girl.
Not much.
Not much. I believe that's true. That brings us then to the next one, next chapter, and I've called this lesson 11, and it is, the overriding, and this for about three chapters, 20, 21, and 22, is all about how to have a good name. And with the idea of a good name, it really has no reference to, would you turn that amp off, please, Bill? Has no reference to how you pronounce it or how you spell it, but altogether refers to the character and the credibility represented by the name. I'm not doing that, Richard. I'm standing very still. You know it's on the CD because you took it out. Okay, the very first verse, he starts out here with something that is a good subject to talk about. And for the first 30 verses, the 30 verses of this chapter is abstain from vices that destroy your character. And the first verse has to do with addiction to strong drink. And he says, wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. Wine is a mocker. It's a mocker because it makes false promises. It makes promises that it can't deliver on. It's sweet to the taste. It's relaxing to the nervous system. but the insidious evil that comes with alcoholic beverages is very slow to creep up on people. And I know that we've all known people who have had this happen to them. The word wine appears many, many times in Scripture. The New Testament, you're aware, was written in the Greek language. The Old Testament was predominantly written in the Hebrew language. In the New Testament, all of the times that the word wine appears in the New Testament, it's a translation from one Greek word, which is pronounced oinos. And that Greek word could be fresh-squeezed grape juice, or it could be fermented, intoxicating grape juice, either. And you have to determine what it is by the context in which it's used. However, in the Old Testament, there's no less than 17 Hebrew words that have been translated wine. And if you look them up in Strong's Greek and Hebrew Dictionary, some of them clearly mean fresh-squeezed grape juice, and some of them clearly mean intoxicating grape juice. For instance, in Genesis chapter 9 and verse 21, "And he drank of the wine and was drunken, and he was uncovered within his tent." This is when Lot fled after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. He fled to the mountains and lived in a cave, I suppose, or a tent in the mountains, and his two daughters went with him. And it tells in Genesis there that they got him drunk on wine. They were scared to death that they wouldn't have any offspring, and they were going to be up there in the mountains by themselves. So they had sex with their father. And the first thing they did is it says that they got him drunk on wine. That word is yayin, and it's used many times in the Old Testament. In Strong's Greek and Hebrew Dictionary, it's reference number 3196. And it just appears over and over and over again. And it clearly means intoxicating grape juice. And it also means that in the context. It's when it's used in most places. Many times in the Old Testament, like in Genesis 27 and 28, Moses records there, "Therefore God gave thee of the dew of the heaven and the fatness of the earth and plenty of corn and wine." That word is tirosh. Tirosh is used a lot of times in the Old Testament, and it clearly means fresh squeezed grape juice. So we can't just go on the basis that every time that the Bible says wine, it means an intoxicating grape juice. The Hebrew language is a very mature language, been around for thousands of years, longer than the English language. The Greek language is the same way. And so we don't have many words to translate these words into. So the only word that we have is wine for this. And it's been translated wine throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament. If we, however, were literate in Hebrew, and we could read in the Hebrew language, then we could see very clearly that sometimes wine means fresh squeezed grape juice. Sometimes it means fermented grape juice. And there's many more examples of this. Kamar is another, which is kind of a generic word for wine. It could mean either. Sobe is another one that has to do with drinking while you're carousing or at a party or at a bar or something like that. And that's used in Isaiah chapter 1 and verse 22, where Isaiah said, "The silver is become dross, thy wine mixed with water." So that's what it means there. In Isaiah 1 and verse 22, that's the same one. In 49 and 26, he says, "I will feed them that oppress thee with their own flesh, and they shall be drunken with their own blood and with sweet wine." That word is ausis, and it means fresh squeezed grape juice that was just trodden out. So that's brand new grape juice that just came out of the press. So the most troubling reading that we have really the Testament, where the word that's used there in the Greek language is oinos, and it's always translated one. You have to look at the context to see whether it's clear grape juice or it is fermented grape juice. And you're talking about at the wedding feast in Cana? I don't think that anybody should think that the Lord would have turned water into something that God's Word predominantly and fundamentally condemns all the way through. I mean, it says in Proverbs chapter 23, I believe it was. I thought I put that on here, but I guess I didn't. But it says, look not on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly and swirls around easily and goes down smoothly. That word there is fermented. It's fermented grape juice. It's alcoholic grape juice. And all through the Old Testament, it fundamentally condemns the use of fermented grape juice or alcoholic grape juice. So I don't think it would, in context, I don't think it would be realistic to think that Jesus, the Son of God, turned 120 to 180 gallons of water into alcoholic grape juice for these partiers to drink when it's something that's fundamentally condemned in the Bible, the use of it. Now, there are certain medicinal purposes that wine, fermented wine, was used for, and the use of that was lauded in the Old Testament. So, you know, I'm not gonna get into that side of it. That's between, you know, the wine that they had in the Old Testament had nothing like the quantity of alcohol in it that NyQuil has. You know, for instance, I mean, it's about 60%. It's, you know, so. Glenn. Yeah. And, you know, they were further advanced than we think. You know, if you study about this particular subject from the Bible and also external to the Bible, they had the capability to dry the grape juice and then reconstitute it with water. So this old idea is that they had to keep the grape juice around and it's going to spoil, you know, and it's going to become alcoholic and fermented, and then that's the only thing they have to drink. That really doesn't hold water, no pun intended, because they could condense the grape juice down to a syrup, and then they could keep it where it would not spoil, and then they could reconstitute it with water later. And so I think a lot of times we think that these people were just not very advanced from a civilization standpoint, nor from a technology standpoint. And if you study world history, you can find out that 3,000 years ago, they were pretty well advanced from what we normally think they were. They had manufacturing facilities. They built things. People went to the hardware store and bought plows and all kinds of things like that to use on the farm. And yeah. Well, I think what that means is that what he turned it into was just the freshest, sweetest grape juice of all. That was better than what they started out with. It was the best. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I have too. It's hard to argue. We don't know. Now, I've studied this too. that the wine that they had back in those days, at its worst, was probably a 5 to 6 percentage of alcohol, which was a fairly non-destructive wine, which doesn't compare even closely to the produced wine that we have today. Right.
Well, if it's not alcoholic, why would he care how much they drink?
I think from the context there, that's talking about fermented grape juice, alcoholic grape juice. That's what I meant when I said you have to take it in the context. I don't think that there's any prohibition against elders and deacons drinking Welch's grape juice out of the bottle today. Yeah. So, but still the fact remains that in the Greek, in the New Testament, there's only one word that was translated to one word. Oinos was translated to wine. I haven't been able to find any other Greek word that was used in the New Testament other than that.
What's the word translated?
I don't know. Tom and Leo. Tom and Leo. I will know that tomorrow, Tom. By 1 o'clock tomorrow, I will know that. No, you're not. It's probably oinos. It's probably the same word.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. We don't have a lot of fruits mentioned, you know, in the New Testament anyway. You know, it's mostly grapes and pomegranates and the cucumbers. Yeah? Yams? I didn't intend to spend that much on it. We're nearly done there. And then in verse 2, everybody look at verse 2. What are you laughing about? Because it says this is about obedience to civil law. Obedience to civil law. And this is almost the same verse that we looked at a couple of chapters ago. The wrath of the king is like a roaring lion. Whoever provokes him to anger sins against his own life. And if you'll remember, we went back and read from Romans chapter 13, and it says there that the civil government is not a terror to good people. The civil government is, let's just say, the police force. The police force is not a terror to good people. The police force is a terror to people that don't want to stay within the framework of the law. That's who they're a terror to. There's another scripture that's almost the same that's written by another New Testament writer, Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 2. In verse 13, and he says, therefore submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether to the king as supreme or to governors as to those who are sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, for the praise of those who do good. This is saying clearly that God sent these people. He ordained civil government for people to punish evildoers and to praise those who do good. And they do a pretty good job of that. For this is the will of God, that by doing good you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, yet not using liberty as a cloak or vice, but as bondservants of God. And then this great line that there's been probably thousands of sermons, and I have one that is just this sentence, and it is, honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. And you can talk about that a long time. But we are to be in subjection to the laws of the land. We're supposed to do it. Even said to pay your, you know, if you owe taxes, you need to pay them. You need to, and if it's to Caesar, then you need to render them to Caesar. Now, there have been tyrannical governments, you know, and they usually do not stand. I think of King Saul back in David's day, back in 1 and 2 Samuel. And King Saul finally met an untimely end, but King Saul was a bad king. He was an oppressive king. He didn't treat people right. He didn't do things according to God's will. God didn't want them to have a king in the first place. But the people demanded a king. They said, no, we want a king. And so they got a king. There's a sermon based on that. Be careful what you pray for. You might just get it. And they prayed for a king, and they got a king. So they got one. The next section from verse 3 to verse 4, work ethic. And we only have 3 or 4 more minutes. We'll go ahead and do this one, and then we'll make a mark there. But he says in verse 3, it is honorable for a man to stop striving, since any fool can start a quarrel. Strife serves no good person, no good purpose. Strife, I looked it up in the dictionary, and it says, a bitter, sometimes violent conflict or dissension, an act of contention, a contending against opposition. So it's someone that always just wants to stay in opposition to what other people want to do, or to what is right and good, or to what is legal, or to what God says to do, and we're supposed to be peaceable people. We're supposed to be peaceful people, Christians are. We're not supposed to be in a fuss or a fight. We're not supposed to be striving or contending with someone all the time, and we're supposed to be the best at getting along with other people. And not constantly being in a fight like that. And then he talks in the next verse again about the lazy man. And we'll leave the lazy man then till next week.